Welcome to The Deep Dive. We're the show where we grab a, well, a monumental career, spread out all the source material, and really dig into the surprising facts, the context you actually need.
Yeah, what's behind the headlines?
Exactly. And today, we're deep diving into Alan Stewart Franken.
Yeah,
I mean, here's a figure whose whole professional life, it almost feels like some kind of sociological experiment.
Right. Like, what happens when you take this Harvard-educated, Pulitzer-nominated, actually Grammy-winning satire icon.
Right. A comedy giant.
And drop him straight onto the Senate floor. It's quite the premise.
It really is. And the story itself, well, it's remarkable, but also, like, genuinely contradictory, isn't it?
Completely. You've got one of the original writers for Saturday Night Live. I mean, the creative force behind some of the most influential political comedy of the last, 50 years?
Easily.
And then he somehow successfully transitions into this role as, a serious policy-driven legislator, achieves this historic election win.
Barely historic. Incredibly close.
Incredibly close, yes. And yet, his political journey just crashes and burns. Ends in this really rapid, controversial resignation right in the middle of the seismic shifts of the hashtag MeToo movement.
Yeah, it was fast. So our mission for you, the learner, is really to unpack that full, complex story of Al Franken. We're going to trace his path, from being a young guy idolizing these anti-establishment comedians.
Lenny Bruce, Dick Gregory.
Exactly. Through decades spent shaping comedy and political activism, which then leads to, one of the most razor-thin, legally fought-over election victories in American history.
The nail-biter doesn't even cover it.
Not even close.
Yeah.
And look, we're not going to shy away from that controversial ending either, or, importantly, the sort of reevaluation that's happened since he left office.
No, we have to cover that. And the source material we've got, it actually gives us a pretty clear view across all three major phases of his life, right?
Right.
The comedy guy, the writer, then the progressive activist and author, and finally, the dedicated senator.
So we'll be looking at how those traits, the ones forged in that, cutthroat TV world,
mm-hmm.
how they both maybe prepared him for Washington, but also ultimately perhaps doomed his time there.
Yeah, it's a fascinating interplay.
Okay, let's unpack this, starting right at the beginning. The architecture of the man and that launch pad, 30 Rock.
Yeah.
So Alan Stewart Franken, born in New York City, 1951. But the sources, they're really quick to say, look, he's a Minnesotan.
Right. Moved there when he was 4, settled in St. Louis Park.
Yeah. But what really jumps out right away is this kind of contrast between his, intellectual seriousness and where he ended up career-wise, at least initially.
That's a perfect place to start, actually, because he wasn't just, the funny guy in the drama club. He graduated from the Blake School back in 69, and while he was there, he was disciplined enough to be on the wrestling team.
Wrestling. Huh. Didn't know that.
Yeah. And that sort of competitive discipline streak, it definitely carried through to his academic side. He went to Harvard College, graduated cum laude in political science in 73.
Okay, so poli sci, that's key.
It's crucial because it means he had these really deep roots in political theory, political structure, long before he ever wrote a single joke for TV.
And you can see how that grounding kind of shaped the comedy he liked, right?
Yeah.
The sources mentioned his heroes weren't just guys telling punchlines.
No, not at all. They were the figures who challenged power. Specifically, people like Dick Gregory and Lenny Bruce.
Bruce especially. I mean, he weaponized humor, didn't he, to just expose corruption, hypocrisy.
Exactly. He saw comedy not just as, escapism, but as a form of, moral and political commentary. He and his writing partner, Tom Davis, they were partners for a long time.
A long time, yeah.
They actually honed that kind of politically charged satire at the Brave New Workshop Theater right there in Minneapolis.
Ah, so they were practicing this deep political critique way before they hit the national stage.
Way before. And that partnership, Franken and Davis, that was absolutely integral to the birth of Saturday Night Live.
Absolutely. When they joined SNL in 75, they weren't just hired hands. They were the core, original writers, sometimes performers too.
Foundational. And it's kind of wild to think about the money back then. The sources confirm it. Their shared salary for both of them in that first groundbreaking season, just $350 a week.
$350.
Mm-hmm.
Between two guys. In New York City.
I know. It was truly a ground floor operation, right? Built on chaos and, flashes of genius, and they quickly became architects of that whole show's structure.
And his track record there, it's pretty undeniable. Over his whole SNL career, he had, what, 15 Emmy nominations?
15 nominations, yeah. And won 5 Emmys for writing and producing. So he wasn't just there. He was actively shaping the cultural output.
Definitely. And his work, it went from the totally absurd to something almost therapeutic. We probably need to talk about Stuart Smalley for a second.
Oh, yeah. Stuart Smalley, the soft-spoken, self-help character. I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, and doggone it, people like me.
That's such an iconic catchphrase.
It is. And the depth of Smalley is actually kind of fascinating. People often say Franken created him to gently, you know, poke fun at the 12-step recovery movement.
Right, satirize it.
But sources close to him also point out that he drew a lot from his own experiences, his own therapy, his own self-doubt.
Ah, interesting. So it wasn't just mockery.
No, I think the character really resonated because it tapped into genuine human insecurity, but filtered through his, you know, signature satirical lens. It wasn't just a funny voice. There were layers there.
He also did that whole meta-comedy thing that was big back then, didn't he?
Uh-huh.
Declaring the 1980s the Al Franken decade.
Oh, yeah, the Al Franken decade, which was funny, mostly because of the sheer brazen ego it projected.
Totally. But if you want the one line that really cemented his place in comedy writing history, a line people still quote, maybe controversially.
Has to be from Point Counterpoint, right?
Absolutely. Mm. The sources explicitly confirm Franken wrote that famous line Dan Aykroyd delivered. Jane, you ignorant slut.
Wow. Okay. That perfectly captures the whole vibe of that segment, doesn't it? Combative, totally politically incorrect, but somehow hilarious at the time.
Exactly. But you know, even though he was this core pillar of the show for 20 years, 75 to 95, basically.
Yeah, a long run.
His time there was punctuated by conflict, wasn't it? Which kind of seems to reflect that competitive nature we talked about earlier. There were two big departures, both tied to power struggles.
Yeah, the first one, back in 1980, really shows his willingness to bite the hand that feeds him, so to speak.
What happened there?
He did this Weekend Update commentary piece called A Limo for a Lamo. And it was just a direct, absolutely brutal attack on the NBC president at the time, Fred Silverman, who was pretty controversial himself.
He went on Weekend Update and called the head of the network
a total unequivocal failure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Used charts and everything to show NBC's terrible ratings right there on air.
Wow. Okay. Didn't pull punches.
Not at all. And the consequence was immediate. Silverman blocked Lorne Michaels' plan to make Franken the new show producer. So Franken left along with Lorne.
Ah, okay. So that competitive spirit, that willingness to just challenge authority publicly, that definitely shows up later in his political career.
Absolutely. It's a defining trait. And his second exit in 1995 was just as messy. He basically left in protest because he didn't get the Weekend Update anchor job.
He thought he'd earned it, right?
Well,
and they gave it to Norm Macdonald instead.
Exactly. It was a very public power struggle over that coveted chair. It just illustrates that whole internal dynamic.
Yeah.
He was brilliant, competitive, fiercely loyal to his people. But yeah, maybe his pride could be a stumbling block.
Yeah, seems like it. But amidst all that chaos of 70s and 80s TV, there was also this moment of, like, personal reckoning. The sources mentioned he admitted to using illegal drugs back then.
Yeah, cocaine, among other things, while working on the show, which, you know, wasn't uncommon in that scene at that time.
True. But he also clearly stated he stopped. Completely stopped.
Mm-hmm.
After his colleague John Belushi died from that fetal overdose.
Right. That's a really powerful moment of, like, self-correction, isn't it? It shows this pivot towards personal seriousness, maybe moving away from some of the more destructive parts of the entertainment world.
And it kind of foreshadows that huge shift towards political responsibility that was coming up next in Act Two.
Exactly. That pivot to seriousness, it wasn't just personal, it really accelerated into his whole professional identity. Act Two, this is where we see him transition from writing sketches to being a full-time political commentator.
Right, and he's using that comedic voice, but now it's like a razor-sharp tool for progressive activism.
He totally transformed himself. He started taking on specific targets, mostly on the right, in print. And his books, they weren't just funny throwaway.
No, they were bestsellers, New York Times bestsellers.
Yeah, titles like Rush Limbaugh is a Big Fat Idiot and other observations back in 96. And then Lies and the Lying Liars Who Tell Them. A fair and balanced look at the right in 2003. These were seriously researched, fact-checked political critiques just wrapped in his trademark satire.
They were detailed. And what's really fascinating and kind of speaks to his unique ability to bridge that gap between serious policy and entertainment.
Yeah.
He won 2 Grammys for these books.
2 Grammys, yeah. For the audiobooks, which he read himself. Best comedy album for one, best spoken word album for the other.
That's not typical for political books.
Not at all. It just highlights that he'd found this unique sweet spot. He could make serious political arguments digestible, memorable, even funny enough for the entertainment industry to recognize.
While still being substantive enough to really challenge the political establishment.
Precisely. And speaking of challenging the establishment, that second book, Lies and the Lying Liars, that led to one of the most brilliant, though maybe unintentionally so, marketing wins in publishing history, the Fox News showdown.
Oh yeah, this was gold. Fox News actually sued him, right?
They did. They filed a lawsuit claiming he infringed on their registered trademark, Fair and Balanced, just by using it in the subtitle of the book.
Which, I mean, the subtitle was A Fair and Balanced Look at the...
You're right.
Right. The whole point was the irony.
Exactly. The sources really emphasized just how absurd the legal claim was on its face.
And the judge thought so, too.
Oh, yeah. The federal judge basically threw it out, calling the lawsuit wholly without merit. Which, of course, instantly just validated Franken's entire point about conservative media overreach.
But the lawsuit itself backfired spectacularly on Fox.
Massively. All the media coverage generated by the lawsuit, all this free press detailing the fight between Fox News and Al Franken, it just propelled the book straight to number one on Amazon. Sales shot up.
So Fox, trying to suppress his critique, actually ended up giving it the biggest possible platform.
Textbook Streisand effect applied to political satire. Just perfect.
So after that book success, he decides to take his progressive commentary to the radio waves, trying to counter that perceived conservative dominance in talk radio.
Yeah, in 2004, he launches the Al Franken Show on the new progressive network Air America Radio. And initially, he even used the title The O Franken Factor.
Nice little poke at Bill O'Reilly there.
Definitely cheeky. But his motivation here, it seems pretty clear from the sources, wasn't really about entertainment anymore. It was pure activism.
Yeah, there's that quote from him in 2004 where he says, basically, I'm doing this because I want to use my energies to get Bush unelected.
That's the language of a political operative, right?
Right.
Not just a detached comedian making jokes. So this radio show, which ran until 2007, it really feels like the final training ground before he made the leap to actually running for office himself.
And that transition, that decision to run, it was heavily influenced by one person in particular, wasn't it?
Deeply influenced, yeah, by the late Minnesota Senator Paul Wellstone. Wellstone was Franken's political mentor, his role model. Franken really saw him as the absolute epitome of a progressive public servant.
Like the gold standard for him.
Totally. And the specific thing that pushed him to finally run, the sources say, was actually a direct challenge to Wellstone's legacy.
What was that?
The Republican incumbent senator, Norm Coleman, who had actually taken Wellstone's seat after Wellstone died, Coleman made this comment that he considered himself a 99% improvement over Wellstone.
Oof. Okay, Franken wouldn't have liked that.
No, he apparently took that as a deep personal affront to the kind of progressive politics he really admired in Wellstone.
So the wheels start turning. He announces he's moving back to Minnesota in 2005.
Which is a crucial step, right? You got to establish residency, reconnect with the state before you can run. He wasn't just thinking about it. He was actively executing this professional shift.
And he set up a PAC.
Right.
Right, the Midwest Values PAC.
He did. And it wasn't just about raising money for himself. It was also a way to support other candidates and causes that kind of reflected Wellstone's progressive ideals. And by early 2007, that PAC had already pulled in over $1 million. So it shows he was serious about laying the financial and political groundwork.
And his policy positions were starting to solidify, too, moving towards a clearer progressive platform as he geared up for the Senate run.
Yeah, back in 2004, he'd already publicly favored moving towards a universal healthcare system. And on the big issue of the time, the Iraq War, he kind of navigated this complex political evolution.
How so?
Well, initially, he actually supported the war, said he'd been convinced by Colin Powell's presentation to the UN, which a lot of people were at the time.
True.
But that support definitely flipped later. By 2007, he was actively opposing the troop surge and was calling for Congress to actually defund the war, but without setting specific exit timetables.
Okay, so that's kind of a nuanced position for a progressive candidate, right?
Right.
Supporting the initial decision, but then strongly opposing the continuation.
It is strategically tricky, yeah. But it showed he wasn't afraid to evolve on a major issue and make a tough policy call, even if it wasn't perfectly clean. He was clearly calculating, fundraising, testing the political waters.
Moving from being just a media personality to a really serious contender for one of the most powerful offices in the country.
Yeah. And all of this just perfectly set the stage for Act Three, which wasn't just an election. It was, I mean, a political saga that basically redefined the term too close to call.
Act 3. The senator of 312 votes. Okay, so Franken announces he's running for Senate on his very last Air America show, February 2007. Fast forward to November 2008, and he is locked in what just becomes this absolute political thriller against the incumbent, Norm Coleman. We really need to convey the tension here because this wasn't just close. It was a legislative marathon.
Excruciating is probably the right word. So election night, the initial reports come in, and they show Coleman leading by over 700 votes. Okay, maybe a bit close, but looks like Coleman won.
Right, but then...
Once the official results are actually certified, the margin just evaporates. Coleman is ahead by only 215 votes out of nearly 3 million cast.
Wow. 215 votes out of 3 million.
Yeah, it's a 0.01% difference, which, under Minnesota state law, automatically triggers a statewide recount.
And this wasn't just pushing a button on a machine recount. This was hands-on.
Oh, completely hands-on. Highly politicized, intense public scrutiny. Every single ballot was being examined by lawyers and representatives from both campaigns.
And they're challenging everything, right? Like a stray mark here, an oval not filled in perfectly there.
Everything. The atmosphere must have been just incredibly tense. The whole state, probably the whole country, was watching this unfold, ballot by ballot.
And this back and forth, this scrutiny, it actually leads the state canvassing board to initially certify the results, with Franken ahead now.
Yeah, by a slim 225 votes. But that was really only the beginning of the fight. Coleman immediately filed an election contest.
So court.
Yep. Kicked off a multi-month trial in front of a special three-judge panel.
And this trial, this becomes the real turning point, doesn't it? Because the panel makes a key decision about certain ballots.
They do. They ordered the counting of 351 specific disputed absentee ballots. These were ballots that had previously been rejected by local officials, often for just minor technical reasons.
Like maybe a signature didn't perfectly match or something like that.
Exactly. Things like that. And that tiny stack, just 351 ballots, it changed everything.
How much did it change the count by?
Once those were opened and counted, they ultimately raised Franken's lead to 312 votes.
312.
Just think about that. 312 votes deciding a U.S. Senate seat out of almost 3 million cast. It's staggering.
It really underscores the power of every single vote, doesn't it? And every single legal challenge, I guess.
Absolutely. But the legal drama wasn't over even then. It dragged on for 246 days after the election. Coleman appealed the result all the way up to the Minnesota Supreme Court.
8 months. The seat was empty for 8 months.
Incredible, right? The tension just held for that long. Finally, June 30th, 2009, the Minnesota Supreme Court unanimously rejects Coleman's final appeal.
And that was it.
That was it. Franken was sworn in just a week later, July 7th, 2009, and he took the oath of office using Paul Wellstone's Bible.
Wow. A victory won through sheer grinding legal persistence.
Absolutely. So after all that chaos getting into the Senate, the sources really detail Franken making this very deliberate choice. He completely pivoted away from the media spotlight, away from his comedy persona.
He wanted to be seen as a workhorse, right? Not a show horse.
Exactly. He focused intensely on policy, on constituent work. He really wanted to be taken seriously.
And did it work? Was he effective?
He actually proved to be exceptionally effective, especially considering he started as the absolute most junior member of the Senate. His very first bill, which he co-wrote with a Republican senator, Johnny Isaacson.
Bipartisan, okay.
Yeah, right out of the gate. It was the Service Dogs for Veterans Act. It set up a VA program to pair disabled veterans with service dogs. Getting that bipartisan win so early was really crucial for establishing his credibility.
That makes sense. But his biggest impact, according to the sources, was really in major legislation, particularly the Affordable Care Act, right? The ACA.
Oh, undoubtedly. He authored this absolutely crucial amendment called the Medical Loss Ratio, or MLR. And this is like a textbook example of really complex policy having a massive direct benefit for consumers.
Explain the MLR. What did it actually do?
Okay, so before the MLR, insurance companies could spend, you know, a huge chunk of your premium dollars on things like administrative overhead, massive CEO salaries, marketing, whatever, instead of actual medical care.
Right. Money not going to healthcare.
Exactly. Franken's MLR amendment basically forced a level of consumer protection. It mandated that insurance companies had to spend a minimum percentage of the premiums they collected, 80% for small group plans, 85% for large group plans, directly on healthcare costs and quality improvement activities.
80 or 85 cents of every dollar.
Precisely. And the distinction here is critical. It wasn't just a suggestion. It had teeth. If the insurers didn't hit that threshold, if they spent too much on overhead or profit,
they had to pay it back.
They had to issue rebates directly back to consumers or employers. It fundamentally changed the basic economics of the health insurance industry in the U.S.
Wow. That sounds like a fight.
Oh, it was fiercely fought by the insurance lobby, which kind of tells you how effective it was.
Yeah.
And this kind of work, you know, technical, complex, focused on protecting regular people from big financial institutions, that really defined his Senate tenure. It was a million miles away from writing SNL sketches.
Definitely a different world. He also took on issues around workplace justice, didn't he? Something about mandatory arbitration.
Yeah, he was apparently deeply moved by the story of Jamie Lee Jones. She was a woman who alleged she was sexually assaulted while working for a defense contractor overseas, KBR. But her employment contract had this mandatory arbitration clause, which basically prevented her from suing the company in open court.
Ah, so she was forced into this private system.
Exactly. Mandatory arbitration forces employees to settle disputes, including really serious ones like sexual assault and discrimination claims, completely out of court, behind closed doors, often in these private arbitration systems that can be heavily favored towards the company.
Got it. So what does Franken do?
He championed what became known as the Jones Amendment. It was attached to the 2010 Defense Appropriations Bill, and what it did was limit the use of mandatory arbitration for defense contractors, these huge companies that get billions in government contracts in cases involving workplace sexual assault, harassment, and discrimination.
So it allowed those employees to actually take these powerful companies to a real court.
Yes, to a public court of law. It was a massive win for employee rights and corporate accountability, especially against these really powerful government contractors.
That's significant. And, you know, for all this seriousness, he hadn't totally lost his touch with the public, had he? There was that viral video from the Minnesota State Fair.
Oh, yeah, 2009. That video became famous because he was shown engaging with this group of pretty angry Tea Party protesters about the details of the healthcare reform bill.
And why did it go viral?
Specifically because of the civility he maintained throughout the whole thing. He was patient. He was focused on the actual policy details. He was respectful, even though he was dealing with this really energized, hostile crowd.
Huh. It's like it perfectly captured that dual identity, right? The competitive policy wonk who could still connect or at least engage patiently using just facts.
Exactly. And by 2014, the transformation seemed complete. The sources confirm his re-election victory that year was decisive. He got 53.2% of the vote.
Which was a big jump from the 312-vote squeaker in 08.
Huge jump. He'd gone from being a top Republican target in 2008 to being seen as a heavy favorite by 2014. He'd successfully established himself as this reliable, effective legislator, a serious fundraiser, a serious policy guy in the Senate.
Yeah, it really seemed like he'd made the transition permanent. No one, absolutely no one, saw the sudden collapse that was literally just around the corner. Which brings us, to Act Four, the sudden and for many tragic end to this historic political career in 2017. The sources really lay out this rapid, almost dizzying chain of events that started with that first public allegation in November 2017.
Yeah, that first accusation came from Leanne Tweeden, who's a radio broadcaster and former model. She alleged that back during a USO tour rehearsal in 2006, Franken had forcibly kissed her.
What were the specifics, she alleged?
She described it pretty vividly, said he came at me, put his hand on the back of my head, mashed his lips against mine, and aggressively stuck his tongue in my mouth. She said she pushed him away and felt disgusted and violated.
Okay, that's a serious allegation. And then there's the photo.
And then there was the photo, which became really the defining image of the whole scandal. It accompanied her accusation.
Describe the photo again.
It was taken during that same 2006 USO tour. It shows Franken mugging for the camera, holding his hands up as if grabbing or hovering just above Tweeden's chest area while she was asleep on a military transport plane. She was fully clothed, wearing body armor and a helmet at the time.
And Franken's response to that photo?
He responded quickly, called it a failed attempt at a joke, said it wasn't funny, admitted he shouldn't have done it. But he also maintained that his memory of the rehearsal kiss she described was very different from hers.
Okay. But that first accusation, plus that really damaging photo, it seemed to open the floodgates, didn't it?
It really did. The sources note that within weeks, seven additional women came forward with their own accounts. These mostly detailed a range of what they described as inappropriate touching, usually during photo ops at public events or political gatherings.
What kind of touching were they describing?
Well, the range included multiple women who alleged that he grabbed or squeezed their clothed buttocks while posing for photos. Another allegation came from an army veteran, Stephanie Kemplin, who claimed Franken put his hand on the side of her breast and held it there for maybe 5 to 10 seconds during a photo op on a USO tour in Iraq back in 2003.
Okay.
Another woman reported getting an open mouth, sort of wet kiss on the cheek after she turned her face away during a handshake. This was after an appearance on his radio show in 2006.
So a pattern alleged, mainly around photo lines and public interactions. How did Franken respond to these additional claims?
He issued a broader apology then, saying he regretted making some women feel uncomfortable, acknowledging he had crossed a line for some women in certain interactions. But he also consistently maintained that he remembered some of these encounters very differently than the way they were being described.
And he supported an ethics investigation, right?
Yes. He immediately said he welcomed and would cooperate fully with a Senate Ethics Committee investigation, which was initiated fairly quickly with support from leaders in both parties.
But the Ethics Committee investigation never finished, did it?
No. And this is really the critical juncture where the political momentum just completely overtook the standard investigative process.
What happened?
The sources confirm that within a very short time frame, more than 24 Democratic senators, led very publicly by Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York, called for Franken's immediate resignation. Before the Ethics Committee had done its work, before it reached any findings.
Wow. So pressure from within his own party.
Immense pressure. The sources detail that the Senate Minority Leader at the time, Chuck Schumer, basically confronted Franken, told him he needed to announce his resignation by 5 p.m. that day.
Or else what?
Or face the consequences, which would likely include being formally censured by the Senate and stripped of all his committee assignments.
Which would make him completely ineffective as a senator.
Completely powerless, yeah. Unable to do the legislative work he prided himself on. Censure itself is a formal public rebuke that, you know, permanently stains a political career. Faced with that kind of ultimatum from his own party leadership.
He resigned.
He announced his intention to resign on December 7th, 2017, and it became effective January 2nd, 2018.
And in his resignation speech, he didn't hold back on the irony he felt, did he?
No, he specifically pointed out what he called the profound irony, that he was stepping down, while other politicians, he cited President Trump and Alabama Senate candidate Roy Moore specifically, who were facing multiple, often more severe and very high-profile allegations, continued to enjoy the full support of their party, the Republican Party.
Yeah, that was a pointed comment, and the personal cost for him was significant.
Apparently very severe. The sources note that after the resignation, he went through a period of clinical depression, needed medication, and felt this profound sense of isolation from public life.
And politically, that debate about whether he got due process, it didn't really go away after he left, did it?
Not at all. It actually grew louder, especially after some significant reporting came out in 2019. Journalist Jane Mayer published a piece in The New Yorker that documented what she described as substantial inaccuracies in some key parts of Leon Tweeden's original account, particularly around the events of that USO tour rehearsal.
So new information casting some doubt on the initial catalyst.
Exactly. And this new reporting seemed to spur a pretty major reevaluation among some of his former Senate colleagues. It suggested that maybe the initial rush to judgment, that demand for immediate resignation, might have been a political overreach.
Did any senators say that publicly?
Oh, yes. Several prominent Democrats came forward later expressing really profound regret for calling for his resignation when they did. We know former Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, Senator Patrick Leahy, Senator Tom Udall.
What did they say?
Leahy was quoted saying, calling for the resignation was one of the biggest mistakes I've made in his Senate career. Udall flatly said, I made a mistake, and felt Franken had been essentially railroaded and deserved a proper investigation by the Ethics Committee. Reid called the way Franken was treated terrible and unfair.
So a real sense among these senior figures that maybe the process failed him.
Yeah, the consensus among them seemed to be that the desire for swift, decisive moral action in that charged hashtag MeToo moment had dangerously overridden the fundamental principle of due process.
And this also had political consequences for Senator Gillibrand, who led that charge.
It did. She faced accusations from some of Franken's supporters, including some major Democratic donors, of acting opportunistically. One prominent fundraiser was quoted suggesting Gillibrand had kind of stained her reputation as a fair player because of the rushed judgment and that it might burden her future political ambitions.
It really brings us back to Franken's own reflection on it later in 2019. He acknowledged making some women uncomfortable, said he was sorry for that.
Right. He owned that part.
But he also really stressed the importance of differentiating. between different kinds of behavior.
Yeah, he specifically pushed back on the political notion that, quote, anybody who accuses someone of something is always right. He said that's not the case. That isn't reality.
It's a statement that really cuts right to the core of the dilemma, doesn't it?
Yeah.
How do you navigate public accusations, intense political pressure, in an age of instant media judgment? So as that political whirlwind finally started to settle down a bit, we see Al Franken trying to, well, reconstruct his public life. And he seems to be returning, maybe inevitably, to the worlds he knew best, media and entertainment.
He's definitely gone back to his roots, yeah. His post-Senate career looks a lot like his pre-Senate career in some ways. He launched the Al Franken podcast back in 2019.
What's that focus on?
Mostly politics, current events, global affairs, high-level commentary. And he's also been touring pretty extensively with a solo stage show.
Yeah, the one with the title.
The one with the classic self-deprecating Franken title. The only former U.S. senator currently on tour.
Perfect. Gotta appreciate the humor there.
Definitely. And in maybe the most perfect or perhaps inevitable piece of sort of cyclical irony, the sources confirm he's actually returning to scripted acting in 2025.
Doing what?
He's playing a U.S. senator in a Netflix comedy mystery series called The Residence. It'll be his first actual acting role in, like, 27 years.
Wow. So he's literally going back to playing a senator, but this time it's fictional, under circumstances he can actually control.
Kind of poetic, in a way. And you know, that political fire, it doesn't seem completely extinguished either. In an interview in 2022, he did publicly express regret over resigning when he did.
Did he say he'd run again?
He didn't commit, but he did say it would be tempting to run for public office again someday. So that drive for public service, the thing that pulled him from comedy into the Senate in the first place, it clearly still seems to be a pretty powerful force for him.
So what we've really covered today is just this extraordinary distance traveled in a single career. I mean, from the political satire at Harvard Yard and 30 Rock.
Right, through the really complex policy fights in the Senate over things like mandatory arbitration and the medical loss ratio.
And then finally to that just brutal political mechanism that ended his tenure so abruptly. It's a story defined by, wow, high achievement, deep contradictions.
And this really dramatic, high-stakes collision between celebrity politics and accountability in the modern age.
Yeah. It's a really powerful story about the price of public life today, isn't it?
Yeah.
Especially in this hyper-accelerated media environment. And maybe especially for a politician whose life was already kind of built on irony and performance.
That's a great way to put it.
So, considering those repeated, very explicit statements of regret from his former Senate colleagues, you know, powerful figures like Leahy, Udall, Harry Reid, who felt he was denied the internal due process he was entitled to. This really raises an important question for you, the learner, to think about. What responsibility do we hold as informed citizens, as observers, when we're evaluating these complex public accusations, especially when they happen under such intense political pressure? How do we balance that against the need for patience, for waiting for a thorough, maybe impartial investigation?
It's a tough balance.
It is. This raises an important question for you to consider.
Thank you for joining us for this deep dive into the fascinating and definitely contradictory trajectory of Al Franken.